from NPR and the Futuro Media Group.
Welcome to Latinos USA!
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today,
kids!
Yes, kids. Did you know that one out of every four U.S. kindergartners is a Latino? Today we visit the world of children from school and books.
I saw picture books for the first time. Not only they were this piece of art, but I realized that with my very limited English, I could actually understand them.
To detention, an undercover whistleblower talks to us about working with unaccompanied, undocumented children, the real reasons they're coming.
It was five kids, five brothers and sisters that came to our facility because their mom was kidnapped and murdered, all because of money and gang violence.
All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us.
No se vayan.
Pollito, chicken, gallina, hen, lápiz, pencil y pluma, pen, ventana, window y puerta, door, maestra, teacher y piso, floor. Pollito, chicken, gallina, hen, lápiz, pencil y pluma, pen.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. It's good to be back with you this week. And on today's program, kids. Now, I know I do this, and I bet you do too. Idealize childhood as a carefree time of life. Some kids don't have that luxury. Some kids travel alone without any adults for thousands of miles to cross the U.S. border. According to the New York Times, Homeland Security expects over 90,000 unaccompanied minors this year. 5 years ago, the number of kids migrating alone was 19,000. By now, you might have seen the leaked pictures on the internet of the conditions in which our country is housing these children. So, what kind of people would allow these kinds of conditions? What about the attitudes of the people who are charged with caring for these children? If a recent tweet by the union representing the Border Patrol is any indication, we might only be able to expect callous indifference. The tweet complains, babysitting, diaper changing, burrito wrapping, cleaning cells, law enforcement? What's that? Never mind that this influx of immigrant children is driven by a humanitarian crisis in their home countries, usually in Central America. Never mind that many of them have journeyed thousands of miles under conditions where rape and death in a multitude of ways is commonplace. And never mind the way they are treated while held by U.S. authorities. In an exclusive interview, I sat down with a person we'll be referring to as Kay. Kay works as a staff member in a facility that holds migrant children who stay for months at a time. Many of them, some as young as 7 years old, have talked to Kay about what the trip north was like. But Kay says the kids say that the most traumatic part of their thousands of miles long journey hasn't been the threat of violence or rape along the way, but instead the horror of being detained in the United States. In order to protect the children Kay works with, as well as to prevent retaliation against Kay, we have altered Kay's voice. We have agreed to not reveal who you are because, as journalists, our job is to protect our sources. But you have agreed to talk to us. Whose job do you think it is to protect these children?
Right now, it's my personal job to protect them because I am in the environment and I am able to work directly with them. And for me, protecting them, it doesn't mean making sure that they aren't being harmed or anything. It's making sure that emotionally they're being taken care of and that they have a safe place where they can really talk about their experiences. It's everybody's job to protect these kids because ultimately, regardless of where they're from, we all deserve basic human rights that these kids are not necessarily always getting.
Can you tell me what it was like the first time you walked into this place and you realized the work that you were going to be doing, your first impressions?
I was shocked. When I had gone in for my interview, it was all very open, and they actually invited me to sit down and talk to the kids. So I was really able to connect with them right away, but my first day was a day where we had gotten new intakes in, and when I saw that look on their face of fear, that's when I knew, okay, this is serious work. Like, this is not just another after-school program that I've done or another, you know, this is a very vulnerable set of kids that I'm working with, and that's when I realized this is real work.
What was the look on their faces?
It's kind of like the look that you get when you know that you're going to get in trouble for something, but you don't know what you did wrong kind of thing, or almost kind of like, help me face, like, I don't know what's going on.
Do these kids want to talk? Do they want to tell their story?
I'm pretty sure that these kids want to talk about their story. I don't think they feel that they can. I don't think they feel that it's something they're really allowed to do. What I like to do is ask questions just about, where are you from? How long did it take you to get here? And right away, they start opening up about everything else. I ask like one or two questions and they continue for like half an hour. So I feel like they need somewhere to vent, or they need someone to tell their story to, someone that's actually going to listen. I don't think they get the opportunity a lot. From what they've experienced, it's not something that's done.
You've heard now dozens of these stories. What in fact is the story of these kids? What are you hearing?
A lot of things that are coming up are not so much about what the journey was to the United States. Some of these kids are out for a week, maybe 2 weeks. Some kids have even been like trying to get to the States for months. So I was so surprised to hear that most of the stories are all about what it's like in what they call La Hielera, which is the detention centers where they're held.
They call it La Hielera.
Yes.
And what does La Hielera mean?
Well, La Hielera, it's pretty much like a cooler. And one kid, because we in our facility have a kitchen, and he's like, you know what it's like in the walk-in freezer downstairs or in the walk-in refrigerator. He's like, just picture being in there all day, 24/7 for like up to a week. He's like, that's how cold it is. They're being detained in these facilities where it's like being in a walk-in cooler pretty much. And they don't have any windows. The windows that they do have, if they get near the windows, they've seen guards actually beat people up. They don't know if it's daytime or nighttime. They said that they get fed twice a day, and it's bologna sandwiches that are usually frozen and breakfast burritos. Some kids said they only got fed once a day. There's like a room that usually fits about 40, 50 people where they cram in about 95 people to 100 people in the room. One kid expressed that a lot of people sleep standing up because there's just no room to actually lay down. The kids that are there for like a week to like 10 days, they said that during that time they didn't get to shower, they don't get to brush their teeth. They share a bathroom with like 80 other people. And yeah, that's kind of what these kids are experiencing.
There's been a lot of reporting now talking about what is motivating the kids to be moving north. From the stories that you're hearing, what is motivating these kids to leave?
There's definitely a theme. I think a lot of kids that I work with are leaving because of the gang violence in their home countries. I keep hearing stories about the parents that are in the States calling to bring their kids because they're getting threats from the different gangs. There was this one case where one of the kids that was in our facility had to come to the United States because there were threats made to his family, and one of his relatives was actually murdered. There was another case where it was five kids, five brothers and sisters that came to our facility because their mom was kidnapped and murdered, all because of money and gang violence. A lot of the participants that I talked to have expressed not wanting to be in gangs, but the gang members personally going to their house all the time asking for them. And in those situations, if you don't really listen to them, it's danger on your family. 12, 13 years old, you feel like the only thing that you can do is either come to the States or join their gang. And it's gotten so bad that making that week-long journey to an unexpected country is safer than staying home.
In the facility where you work, what is the general attitude of some of your coworkers towards these young people?
I think a lot of the people that work there started off with really great intentions. it just becomes harder to get emotionally involved. So it's kind of like closing people off. In order to protect themselves, it's kind of like, I'm not going to emotionally attach myself. There's a lot of reprimanding for behaviors that normal 13, 14-year-old kids do. It's a lot of discipline. A lot of the work is, don't do this, do this, go to your room. And that's pretty much the conversation. One of the reasons is because we are so understaffed. There really isn't room to always sit down and have conversations. There are a few people that make it a point to sit down and talk to them, even if it's for 2 or 3 minutes. But yeah, like I said, I think a lot of people that are there, it's kind of hard to get attached to a particular kid. Or
who are they released to, if there's any way to give a sense of that?
When I first started, most of the kids would get sent to a family member here in the States. And then from there, they would meet for immigration court and determine whether they get sent back. So that part of the process, we don't have any access to. Lately, maybe 35% of the kids are getting transferred to different facilities instead of going home. So instead of getting unified with family here in the States, they're just getting transferred to a different facility. I hear these stories over and over and over again, and it's, you know that the kids are telling the truth, because there's kids that left 2, 3 months ago that say the same thing as the kid that just got here yesterday. So these two kids never had any communication in order to, like, oh, well, let's say this so it looks like this. It's definitely something that's real and it's a problem. And sitting down with them during their free time or just, like, watching them play games amongst each other, they're still regular 13, 14-year-old kids. Regardless of what they've been through, their attitude is so, it's kind of nice to see, but it's also really sad to think that they have gone through this.
What is the story or the issue that you think Americans need to know about this if they say, but this has nothing to do with me? Why do you think that it has to do with them?
I think it's important for people to know about what's going on, because this could be happening to anybody. This kind of treatment and the things that are happening can happen to anyone. And I think it's important that the stories are told so that regardless of what the population is, people know what their rights are and people know that they have support. I think even if this was happening in any other country, if any other country was doing what we were doing, we would be looking at them like, we need to start rallying, like, this is not fair, you know. And I think we need to kind of look at ourselves and look at what we're doing to these kids and to people in general and, like, the treatment that they're getting. I don't think it's too much to ask to treat people like people.
Our interviewee, Kay, works in a facility that receives migrant children after they are detained by immigration authorities. This is what a whistleblower sounds like. Someone just like you.
Coming up on Latino USA.
What will Niño do now? Wong, blue! Niño makes his puzzle muscles move and Olmec head's mind is blown. It is a real skullcracker punch.
We bring an award-winning children's book to life. Yuyi Morales reads and we play with sounds. Stay with us.
No se vayan.
El ruido de los autos.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Ethnic studies, particularly Latino studies, can provoke a lot of debate. Do these courses exclude non-Latino kids? Do they set kids up to fail or to succeed? In reality, most American high schoolers don't ever take an ethnic studies class, despite evidence that kids, especially kids of color, benefit from learning the heritage and history of all Americans. Valerie Hamilton has more.
En la queche.
En la queche. Tú eres mi otro yo.
Ron Espiritu's ninth grade ethnic studies class starts with a different kind of Pledge of Allegiance. It follows the Mayan idea of in la queche, everyone is one.
Si te amo y respeto, if I love and respect you, mi amo y respeto yo, I love and respect myself.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Here at Animo South Los Angeles High School, ethnic studies is a ninth grade requirement, just like science, English, or math.
When I came into ethnic studies, I was like, what is this? I never knew like Afro-Latinos like had a past that could actually be taught.
That's important because if we don't know where we came from, who are we?
That's Sylvia Hernandez, who just graduated, and Kayla Hicks, who finished ninth grade today. Arlinda Harris is a sophomore. She took the class last year.
One main thing about it that really surprised me was the thing about Christopher Columbus, how he didn't really find America. He basically took it. And that's what really made me, like, realize, like, why didn't we learn this in regular history?
Animo South LA is a charter school, and its ethnic studies requirement is an exception. According to the state's Department of Education, only one in 15 California high schools even offers an ethnic studies class. Only one in 400 students enrolled in one last year. That's despite the fact that more than half of California students are Latino, and almost three quarters don't identify as white. Ninth grader Eduardo Marcos says something's missing.
The schools all over America really aren't leaving out a big chunk of history. I mean, American history isn't just white people from England. It's about the Africans that were also enslaved and the indigenous people that were also taken over and lost their land. Not a lot of schools really teach that.
So as Latino kids grow up, they just don't see themselves represented in the curriculum.
Christine Sleater is a Cal State professor who researches ethnic studies in U.S. schools.
They don't see their reality. They see a reality that is actually, as often the older they get, contradictory to the reality they know from their daily life, and mentally drop out, and then sometimes physically drop out.
I went to a high school that was almost 90% Latino. I never had a Latino studies course in my high school.
That's California State Assembly member Luis Alejo, Watsonville High School class of 92. He says he was a problem kid before he took his first Chicano studies class. That was in college. It turned his life around.
My emphasis became trying to help my community because that course opened my mind to the histories and struggles that I'd never had any knowledge of because it was never taught to me in my high school.
Alejo is trying to pass a law to change that. His measure wouldn't require schools to teach ethnic studies, but it would set up a state commission to develop curriculum. It's similar to a bill that passed and was vetoed 12 years ago. This time, it's likely to pass, but without funding.
The legislative process is very frustrating at times.
Even so, from a national perspective, it's a big step. In April, Texas's State Board of Education voted to develop ethnic studies textbooks, but didn't require schools to use them. And back in 2010, Arizona passed a law actually banning Mexican-American studies in Tucson. That case is before a federal appeals court. But there's another reason for the lack of ethnic studies classes. High school teacher Ron Espiritu.
If you look at so many years of a test-crazed education system, schools are always judged by their numbers.
Many schools focus on teaching to standardized tests that emphasize math and English. Class time spent on ethnic studies, the argument goes, is time that's not spent on other subjects kids need more.
I think the answer is that it doesn't have to be one or the other. It could be both.
Espiritu says his students aren't just learning about their heritage. They're learning how to think through topics that engage them.
It's also about literature. It's also about reading. It's also about writing. It's about critical thinking.
He says once kids connect to school, there's no telling how far they'll go. Animo South LA is a case in point. Its dropout rate is less than half of the district average. Lourdes Vaca is going to the University of California, Irvine, in the fall. She says ethnic studies set her on that path.
It gave me a sense of, like, belonging, and I didn't feel so alienated. So I felt like I had more to do and say, and more to achieve to prove myself.
So we'll start on three. Ready? One.
It's the last day of school, and the last day ninth grade ethnic studies will do their unity clap. As part of a final project, this year's class made pop-up dioramas about topics they studied. Luz Castro got so excited about them, she did three. One commemorated the East L.A. high school walkouts of 1968, where students demanded respect, better education, and the inclusion of Mexican-American history.
It inspired me because we're also high school students, so it's like you don't have to be a certain age to make a change. You could be whatever age to make a change in your education because it matters.
Luz says she's going to take more ethnic studies classes next year. This year, she got an A. For Latino USA, I'm Valerie Hamilton, Los Angeles.
Now, let's go to the wonderful world of children's books. You know, Goodnight Moon and The Giving Tree. Now, I know for a fact that my little kids love that we snuggled in bed every night and read together. They've told me so, now that they're teenagers. The fun of turning the page and finding out what's coming next. I would read the stories and voices, which cracked my kids up. But truth is, most children's books in the U.S. are written by white authors. They feature white characters, and they are geared toward a white audience. Yuyi Morales is an award-winning children's book author and illustrator. Her most recent book, Niño Wrestles the World, features a young Latino luchador taking on challengers from across Mexican mythology. Here's Yuyi Morales, in her own words, talking about her discovery of children's literature and reading from her book, Niño Wrestles the World, which won the 2014 Pura Belpre Award.
Maromas voladoras, máscara contra cabellera, luchadores técnicos contra rudos, niño versus the world.
My name is Yuyi Morales and I write and illustrate children's books.
Señoras y señores, put your hands together for the fantastic, spectacular, one-of-a-kind, Niño!
I always liked drawing. I grew up in Mexico, and I spent most of my childhood just copying anything that I was interested in, starting from Disney characters to any of the portraits in my family's house.
So superb are his talents that out of this world contenders line up to challenge him. Here comes the first one. It is the Guanajuato mummy.
Niño versus la momia de Guanajuato.
I came to the United States from Mexico in 1994. I was a new mother with a two-month-old baby. I didn't even speak English, so one of the places that made a huge difference was the public library.
Oh, no. What is a niño to do? Slish! Suck! Niño defeats the Guanajuato mummy with a tickle tackle.
I saw picture books for the first time. I saw them at the public library. Not only they were this piece of art, but I realized that with my very limited English, I could actually understand them.
Uh-oh. Olmec headways his chance to bump skulls with Niño.
Niño versus Cabeza Olmeca.
When I was making this book, what I wanted it to be was something that resembled the Lucha Libre posters. And then I keep changing. You see another book and you will see something else.
What will Niño do now? Wonk, bloop! Niño makes his puzzle muscle move and Olmec head's mind is blown. It is a real skullcracker. Crunch!
I used to be afraid of those things when I was a kid. I used to be afraid of Las Momias de Guanajuato. My father took us to Guanajuato to see these mummies, and I couldn't believe them.
Ay, mis hijos, my children!
Niño versus La Llorona.
And then what
Latino child is not afraid of La Llorona. Everybody in Mexico I knew was afraid of La Llorona, including me.
Niños del Decoy stuns the whipping woman into submission.
Not only that they know the story of La Llorona, but in fact that they know an uncle, an abuela, someone who has seen La Llorona.
Niño versus el extraterrestre.
My childhood, the way I remember my childhood, is that I spent my days afraid of extraterrestrials coming to my house and taking me with them.
Marble Mash! Niño wins again! Spack! There is no doubt, no opponent is too terrifying for him.
Niño versus El Chamuco.
You know, those stories are very tangible, very, very real. And those were the stories of my childhood. And I was afraid of them. So it was very easy to put them in my book and just celebrate them. Celebrate those emotions and those feelings that we have for those and actually try to defeat them by playing with them.
Niño does it once more. Look at the popsicle sticks.
Ay, 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 ay. Juan,
wow!
That's what we have when we come to a country like the United States. We bring those things from, you know, we carry them. I always imagine that we carry them in our backpacks and las mochilas.
Tick, tock, tick, tock, tick, tock. But then the dreadful hour arrives. Oh, no. His sister's nap is over. Time for Niño to tangle with Las Hermanitas.
Niño versus Las Hermanitas.
I have a son. He's not a niño anymore. He's 20 years old. But my son was very active. And I wanted to honor my love for him in this book, even though now he's past being this little. But I wanted to do something that was like him. Not being afraid of things.
Las hermanitas are rude as wap. Way to hold. What a move. Coochie-coo. Gah. Will they stop at nothing? How is Niño going to win this time?
What could a child celebrate that he's good at, that they are strong at? And I thought, well, first of all, having great imagination. They are so good at playing. They are good at make-believe. And also at being big brothers or big sisters or even small brothers and small sisters.
Niño's best move ever. Taka! If you can't defeat them, join them. Los tres hermanos now accepting all comers.
I wanted to bring all of that in the character of Niño. So even though it was originally inspired by my son and his energy, his bursting energy, it was also inspired in what I thought, what can we all celebrate about children? I wanted my Niño to be that, the embodiment of all the wonderful things that children are.
To see some of the book Niño Wrestles the World, visit our website, latinousa.org.
Señorita, will you marry me? Or perhaps, said Martina, if you tell me how you would talk to me in the future.
It's story time at the New York Public Library. But not just any story time. This reading took place many years ago, and the reader, Pura Belpre, was the first Latina librarian in the city. Alexandra Starr tells us more.
Pura Belpre never intended to stay in New York. She only came for her sister's wedding. But instead of returning to Puerto Rico, she ended up getting a job at the New York Public Library. In 1921, she started working at one of the libraries in Harlem. The neighborhood had a large African-American population and a growing Puerto Rican community as well. Belpre found the library's fairy tale section stocked with stories from around the world. But
she's like, wait, where's Puerto Rico? It's like, ooh, you know, she really talks about how she felt a sense of loss.
That's Marilisa Jimenez, a researcher at the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College. She says Belpre decided to fill the gap and publish folktales she had heard growing up in Puerto Rico.
Children's books have a way of telling you where your place is. That's why when children see that they're not being represented in stories, it's sort of like, do I exist? Am I not part of this story?
Belpre's best-known book is La Cucarachita Martina y el Ratoncito Pérez, or Martina the Cockroach and Pérez the Mouse. In the story, Martina entertains a series of suitors. She asks each how he would speak to her if they were to be married. One of them is a cat.
Meow. Meow.
There's also a rooster.
Kikiriki.
And a frog.
Ba-rum, ba-rum, ba-rum.
The one who wins ba-rum. Martina's heart, though, is the mouse.
Tweet, 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 tweet. Oh, how lovely, said Martina. It sounds just like music. Yes, yes, Señor Pérez, I will marry you.
Belpre used puppets in her story hours. She also read in English and Spanish. It was the first time that was done.
She's a hero. She's a personal hero.
That's Aurora Cerda, founder of La Casa Azul Bookstore, which is holding a tribute to Belpre's life.
Yay! So that was our first story, and now it's time for us to do some activities. Ooh. So we can make puppets at the table, and you can make your own storybooks at the table. So we're going to take a small break.
When Cerda opened La Casa Azul, or the Blue House, in 2012, it became the only bookstore in East Harlem. She's focused on promoting Latino authors and serving the community, known as El Barrio.
She's someone that I think has paved the way for La Casa Azul to exist and really has made it a little bit easier for me, and that I can go to her as a resource for Latino literature and for what we strive to do here at the store.
El ratoncito Pérez cayó en la olla y la cucaracha Martina lo canta y lo llora, lo canta y lo llora, lo canta y lo llora, lo canta y lo llora.
That's the closing of La Cucarachita Martina. It ends on a mournful note. Pérez the mouse ends up drowning in a pot of soup, and Martina the cockroach cries over his body. The image of children hearing her stories decades after her death would have been heartwarming to Belpre, says Marilisa Jimenez.
You know, if you make an impact in a child, it can last.
The American Library Association thinks Belpre made an impact. The highest honor for a young adult writer and illustrator of Latino descent is named after her. It's the Pura Belpre Medal, and it's bestowed in conjunction with the Fame Newbery Award every year. But according to Marilisa Jimenez, Pura Belpre most wanted to be known as the Puerto Rican Johnny Appleseed.
She talks about seeds, story seeds, but to me, the children really were the seeds that she was planting.
For Latino USA, I'm Alexandra Starr in New York.
En una cueva vivo, puedo por las tardes ver la puesta del sol. A veces veo al rey y a la reina pasar.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I am really trying to intentionally say, you're in school now, and where you came from has a place here.
Teachers welcoming immigrant students by embracing their languages. Stay with us.
No se vayan.
Resulta imposible ver en tu mirada Podría pensar que tengo que escarbar Imposible como dejarte ver.
Ella usa vestidos para pasear, inclusive los viste para ir al mar, ir al mar, ir al mar, ir al mar. Ella tiende a vestirlos para matar, en efecto los viste para mutilar y matar. Y matar, y matar, desenterrar amigos, y matar, descuartizar enemigos, oh, oh, oh. Es que hay tantas tantas luces, es que hay tantas luces por apagar, por apagar. Es que hay tantas luces, es que hay tantas luces.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today our show is all about kids, los muchachitos. In California, there are thousands of indigenous Mexican children who speak very little English or Spanish. From the farming town of Watsonville, California, Rowan Moore Garrity reports on a creative approach some teachers are taking to make their schools more welcoming to those whose mother tongue isn't Spanish.
Yeah.
In a first-grade classroom at Ohlone Elementary School, George Feldman has his students say greetings in English, Spanish, and Chinese.
Okay, so go ahead in Chinese.
But when Feldman asks them to say good morning in Mixteco, an indigenous language spoken in southern Mexico, he gets silence and giggles instead.
What about in Mixteco? Uh-oh. Usually I start you out. I say, Tanikundo Navali. And then you say,
Maestro.
Yeah.
Feldman says even that is an improvement.
It took us probably 6 months to get the first kids to correct my horrible Mixtec accent on reading or doing anything from a phrase book.
In the last 10 years, the number of Mixteco speakers in California schools has jumped from 600 to more than 2,000. Many Mixtec families are drawn to California's central coast for work in the strawberry and blackberry fields. Here in Watsonville, there are more than 300 Mixtec students. But you'd never know it from the curriculum.
One of the most basic steps is to fundamentally acknowledge that the kids are there. And in many ways, we're just getting to that point.
The local school district has just one employee that speaks Mixteco. That's language liaison Natalia Gracita Cruz. She visits Feldman's classroom once a week. Today, seated around a low table, Gracita Cruz helps students match written numbers to the sounds that go with them, in English, Spanish, and in Mixteco. Since they're learning three languages at once, she says, she tries to keep them from getting lost in the middle. Then there's another challenge. There are no school books to help Gracita Cruz and Feldman with their trilingual teaching. So they wrote one. It's called I Am Proud of My Family. Their first grade students are just beginning to read it.
I am Mixteco and my family is part of California.
Beside the trilingual text are snapshots of life among Mixtec farm workers in California, packing zucchinis, sorting onions, watering a home garden.
I am really trying to intentionally say, you're in school now, and where you came from has a place here.
Feldman says that's not always clear. He says some Mixtec families don't acknowledge their heritage outside the home.
There is a hidden identity where if kids are from Mexico in your class, you automatically assume they speak Spanish.
Lala.
Leonora is a Mixtec mother with two children in Watsonville Public Schools. In kindergarten, her daughter experienced that hidden identity firsthand. The school nurses gave her hearing exams in English and Spanish, Leonora says. But her daughter didn't understand them well enough to answer, so they thought she was deaf. Growing up in Tijuana, Leonor remembers being teased for her indigenous roots. Now she sees the same attitude among Mixtec parents in Watsonville. A lot of my friends, she says, tell me not to bring them shame by speaking Mixteco in the stores around town. And she says it's rare for Mixtec parents in Watsonville to teach their children Mixteco the way she does. Already, Leonor sees signs of prejudice when she picks her daughter up from school. I think the kids bully her, she says. She doesn't like to speak Mixteco with us. And when we go to meetings at school, she hides. She won't look us in the eye. The Mixteco book aims to counteract some of that embarrassment. But Feldman insists it's just a beginning.
Later on, we're going to get Mixtec voices, Mixtec inclusion, their stories, their past, their histories. I'm haranguing these kids because someday they are going to be the ones who provide that.
For Latino USA, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity in Watsonville, California.
Over a month ago, Duncanville High School in North Texas did a dress code enforcement sweep. Over 150 students were suspended over dress code violations 2 weeks before the end of the year, right before exams. The kids were understandably upset. Their reactions are now being called the Duncanville Dress Code Riots. Mitra Kaboli has more.
In 2003, Duncanville High School implemented a zero-tolerance dress code policy, meaning that all infractions are punishable. The result of this was 700 suspensions at the beginning of the 2003 school year. Duncanville High School's website clearly lays out what the dress code is and why. Some of the rules are:
tops are solid navy or solid white in color.
Tops,
including turtlenecks,
are collared.
Have sleeves
tucked into bottoms.
Bottoms are worn at the natural waistline.
Sagging is not permitted.
Boys are expected to be clean shaven.
Beards and goatees are not permitted.
Mustaches are permitted.
Do not extend
beyond or below the edge of the lips
and are neatly trimmed.
Someone should tell the Duncanville Independent School District that beards are very cool right now. I spent most of my formative years in North Texas, not far from Duncanville. So when I was watching the news reports of all the suspensions about a month ago, I got kind of nostalgic, but without the good feelings. My alma mater's dress code, not unlike many in America, is targeted towards specific groups of people, namely girls and Black and Latino kids.
When schools do things like outlaw baggy pants or wearing hoodies or something like that, a lot of students in poor minority areas see that as actually sort of an affront to their own personal style and the style within their community.
Edward Morris is a professor of sociology at the University of Kentucky. He did some fieldwork at an inner city school in, once again, Texas. Uniforms in public schools, like the ones used in Duncanville, are a way to mask poverty and weed out gang affiliation.
My name is Yamara Taveras. I am a junior. I go to TMA in New York. We had to wear black shoes, no sneakers or anything. Black pants have to be slack. Guys must wear their tie.
Yamara goes to Thurgood Marshall Academy in Harlem. We were talking in a park around the corner from her school. Duncanville High School and Thurgood Marshall are both public schools with very large populations of Black and Latino kids and high rates of poverty. The teachers and staff at these schools want the kids to look appropriate. But the subtext is not lost on the students.
We say, why us? Why do we have to wear uniform? And in some facts, we feel like it's because we're like Latinos and minorities that we're looked upon that we're not capable of learning what is appropriate for a job setting compared to like other kids.
And she's right. Public schools with large populations of minorities are more likely to implement a uniform. Confession time. Back in high school, this straight-A student was also a pothead. So my junior year of high school, I got suspended and had to do a short stint at an alternative school. I had to wear khakis and white shirts, no jewelry, no bags, no books. Nothing came in, nothing came out. I was patted down every morning after I went through the metal detectors. It was like a prison. Sure, we had all gotten in trouble, but we weren't all criminals. I suppose I was. But that was the most unproductive period of my education. Things were supposed to be orderly so we could reform, but it was the opposite. I was way behind by the time I returned to my normal school. So when schools like Duncanville High School pull a mass suspension 2 weeks before exams, it could be considered poor timing.
suspension from school has major negative consequences on achievement. Even just one suspension can lower achievement significantly. Because what happens is you fall behind academically after you get suspended because you're taken out of the learning environment. And then you tend to have worse behavior because you don't understand what's going on in school. So it creates this cycle.
Ed Morris found that Black and Latino kids were monitored way more closely than their white and Asian peers, which also means that Black and Latino kids received more discipline as a result.
Black students are suspended in our research, at 6 times the rate of white students, and Latino students are suspended at 3 times the rate of white students. Then this punishment leads to lower achievement. So we also think that this is something that is actually contributing to racial gaps in achievement.
Suspension and dropout rates are related. A study in California finds that just one suspension will double a student's chance of dropping out. And 68% of the male incarcerated population doesn't hold a high school diploma. Educators are trying to prepare students for their future. Dress for success.
I think there is a subtext to the dress for success idea. How you are dressing now is not appropriate. But these types of behaviors and these styles of dress actually really aren't related to educational success. And in fact, cultivating this top-down approach within the school can be counterproductive to critical thinking skills that really are most important for success in higher education.
As long as you're doing what you got to do in school, which is your work, why would like a certain way how you dress, why should that affect you?
Ed Morris has some ideas on how to reform dress code policies so they aren't such a point of tension between students and staff.
I think that they need to get more student input on that process. And I think they'll find that the students will surprise them in terms of types of dress codes they want. If they feel like they're a part of it and it makes sense to them, then I think it can be a lot more effective.
One last thing. I spoke with the superintendent of the Duncanville Independent School District, Dr. Alfred Ray. He doesn't know if dress code is directly related to academic success, but he says the dress code is not a point of tension between the students and the staff. Duncanville has almost 4,000 students, so the 150-plus that were sent home was not that significant. He also said that the food fight was purely coincidental. For Latino USA, I'm Mitra Caboli.
And mis queridos listeners, we end our show as we do every week with some sabiduría, or some words of wisdom. Now, they often say that wisdom comes with age, but sometimes it feels like the grown-ups are doing it all wrong, and it's the kids who really are the ones who get it. We visited PS 154 in the South Bronx, New York, to get some life lessons from a group of fourth graders. Here's their wisdom.
Hi, my name is Javier Diaz. I live in the Bronx, and I am in fourth grade.
My name is Rocio. I'm a fourth grader.
My name is Janaya.
Hi, my name is Justin Maldonado.
Jada Edwards.
Hi, my name is Natalie. I'm in fourth grade, and I live in the Bronx.
My name is Ayano.
Hi, my name is Mohammed Sineda. I'm in fourth grade. I live in the Bronx.
Hi, my name is Zachary Mitchell.
I think that you should treat other people with care and kindness because if you want somebody to treat you good, so how about you treat them good?
Being a good person is a person that is honest.
What makes a good person is being kind to other people and not telling people to shut up or anything.
Like, if somebody's talking, you have to listen to them.
Also, a good person is someone who does all homework.
Violence is okay when you're trying to defend yourself. But when you're doing violence on purpose, it's not okay because what if you do something to another person and they didn't do anything to you?
Well, depending on what the situation is, like if it's a bank robbery and it's hostages, the only way of getting to stop is to use violence against them.
You should respond in a mature way. So, for example, like a person is giving you attitude, don't give them attitude back. Just be the mature one and do the right thing.
For example, you're in a bank and somebody just comes up to you and like just bumps you. And they like doesn't even say excuse me. If you want to react, you can react. Don't react like bad because then they're going to react back at you and then it's going to start a whole problem. What you should do is like just say, oh, you bumped into me, and if they don't say sorry, they ignore it.
One social issue that I'm really focused about is racism.
We should all have the same rights. Like, just because we're different skin color doesn't mean we have different rights.
People should all treat each other the same, because what if you have a friend that's different skin color than you, and let's say your mom tells you not to hang out with them, how would your friend feel?
It's our external traits. I would change the world by creating peace and stop homelessness.
I'll make sure that no kids get bullied and everyone feels good in the world.
To make the world a better place, I would start a program, and I would try to get people in my program too to try to help out. And we'll go on the websites and try to figure out ways to stop these social issues that people have been going through.
Sabiduría from Ms. Becker's fourth grade class at PS 154 in the South Bronx. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by A.C. Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Mitra Caboli, and Camilo Vargas. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Julia Alsop, Sarah Barrett, Sarah Rocha, Brenda Rodriguez, and Roxanne Scott. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Nell Becker and PS 154 and 9-year-old Rocio Leslie Bonilla for helping out with our billboard. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week. And in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and on Tumblr. And I'll see you on my Instagram, Maria_la_Hinojosa. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I would do what Bon Jovi did.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.